conversation with Miha will be held a little bit like a live podcast, so to speak. So it's a Q&A between the two of us. If you have a question, we invite you to write it into the chat, and I can field it in that way. Otherwise, we will be discussing her wonderful chapter, Soil Making and the Grid of the Atlas: Histories and Imaginings of a Queer Trans Socialist Herbalism. A wonderful title with lots of generative things to spark our interest. And as I mentioned, the book chapter is situated in Post-Communist Grounds in Search of the Commons, a book which has been recently released by Network Cultures in the Netherlands. So I know there's a few other people that are, yes, Miha, you had something.
On my side, the chat seems disabled. So I just says chat disabled. So I wonder if for people it's actually possible to write in the chat.
Okay.
Maybe we can check.
I have. Lovely. Okay. Thank you, testers. Right, I think we'll kick off the conversation. As I say, thanks everyone for joining. Just to introduce Miha Brepinel. I hope I have pronounced your surname, Miha, correctly. Thanks for joining us, and welcome. Miha is a researcher, educator, lecturer, and artist that's based at Winchester School of Art at the University of Southampton. Is originally from Romania, and much of her work has been looking at artistic practices, land practices from that region, as well as from Eastern Europe. And the chapter refers to some of your recent work in that particular sort of space. As I have mentioned, the conversation today is grounded in the book chapter that you wrote, which is part of this month's hybrid conversations. These online conversations are rooted in the current exhibition, The Garden and the Hedge, which is taking place in the Art and Culture House at Kubu on the island of Kemiotone in Finland. The exhibition will be running until the 31st of August, and we welcome you all to check out the full schedule, which is at earthkubu.com. .fi. I'm dropping that into the chat so you can also have a look at that. Next week, just to give a small plug, we will have a talk at the same time, Friday, the 18th of July, with Sarah Roberts, a curator who will be speaking on working in rural contexts. And on Friday, the 29th of August, we have Paul Grandjean, who will, as part of our closing weekend, be speaking about his work on mud machines and other soil endeavors. Those of you who may not know Paul's work, he's a really interesting artist, a French Welsh artist that has been working on soil practices also for many years. And also upcoming in August, we have Andrew Patterson's VJ Manure Jam, and a series of fermentation workshops with the Centre of Social Study of Microbes from Helsinki University, with our closing weekend, as I mentioned, the last weekend of August. So outside of those small plugs and orientation, as you can perhaps imagine from the title, The Garden and the Hedge, and this focus on soil, the program at Kubu is the first in a series of works that are going to take what we call the elemental themes as they're guiding with the earth and soil this year, then followed by water, wind, fire, and ether. And so these conversations then are supporting the exhibition program and the workshop series. So, Miha, I'm really curious what brought you into this, to borrow from the title of your book, Soil Making Practices, and could you share a little bit about your background?
Hey, thank you. So I'm Miha. I grew up, as Teresa mentioned, grew up in Bucharest in Romania, and sometimes in some rural parts of Romania. I use they, them pronouns or no pronouns. I know some languages allow for that, so that's nice. And yeah, like I come to soil making practices through this kind of through history and through some materials that I have found in the library at this place in Masia, that there's also mentioned, which is a self-organized residency space for anybody who wants to come and do artistic creative research work. So it functions like a residency, but there's no like selection process, which allows for anybody to come and do whatever they need. And it also requires some participation in the care of the building and the care of everybody who's there. So it's a very convivial collective space. And it is also in a former school. So there's also a lot of work with the soil there. So there's many things that brought me to this. There's many threads that brought me with it through this to this, and also, as so I mentioned history, I mentioned some materials, I mentioned the space, the research project that I will talk more about, which has to do with the histories of socialist, so-called, or what I call socialist herbalism. And also with the erasure of queer and trans people from these histories. So, therefore, a kind of imagining of what insertions and narrations and retellings we can do from that position, myself trying to build an understanding of this identity in relation to the socialist histories as well.
Thank you for sharing that. And I guess following on from that, socialist herbalism, it sort of captures the imagination. What, how are you defining that? And
Yeah, so it's essentially very specific to the period of socialism in so the project itself refers to Balkans, Southeast Europe, and the Baltics. And I had not much connection to the Baltics until I started going to this space. And so there is a kind of shared history of socialism or lived socialist experience that's very different to where I've been living in the UK. And so here it's a very like different relation to socialism because there isn't within generational and within this or a generation previous lived experience of socialism. So often it is a political horizon, it is a way of that some people come together to organize. But in this project, socialism refers to the historical period of socialism and the specific one of the region that I'm looking at, which is European socialism, and the types of herbalist practices during that historical period. So a very kind of specific, but as a maybe also, I've received this question from people who have come to these gatherings in Masia. So I've organized like four such gatherings, kind of like group residencies where I launch an open call and people come and we actually talk about what this socialist herbalism is. And so questions have come of like, why not anarchist herbalism? So, for sure, I am. It's not necessarily that imagination and horizon. I'm still trying to understand what the imagination and horizon around social or around herbalism for this project can be by drawing from the socialist histories and the practices of herbalism in their complexity under socialist states, whether it is under occupied territories by the USSR or in independent socialist republics like Romania or Hungary or others, or within, let's say, Czechoslovakia or like former Yugoslavia. So, yeah, there's the term socialism is just like a little blanket that can cover this historical geographical area.
No, thank you. That's really useful, I think, and provides like the container, so to speak, for the period and the time and the practices and the location of those practices that you're speaking. I had mentioned to you that I recently, for the first time, actually spent some time in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, mainly on a bike, cycling, and I was really struck by how herbalist practices are very foregrounded and present in a real lively way in everyday life, including summer celebrations, in a sense, which were also very profound to experience. And I think that when I encountered your work, and also from working at Kubu as well, which Finland also holds, such traditions, and Saari, who's one of the co-founders of Kubu, has also spent quite a bit of time also speaking to older women in this part of the world in terms of actually also documenting their kind of practices. So I think it's really interesting context in a sense. But going back to your book chapter. So reading it opens up with this sort of, as you say, a pamphlet that you found in Masia, the Estonian art center that you were working in. And it had all of these imaginaries of like the family walking in the landscape and encouraging people to go out into the landscape and experience the land. And then you sort of juxtapose that with another book that you found in a library in London, which was actually to do with soil and the categorizations of soil, and you sort of weave then a thread between those two kind of items, in a sense, with that book on the categorizations of soil, drawing very much on the Russian, I guess, godfather of soil categorization, Dorkhuvu, yes, thank you. And what was so, I guess, first of all, expand a little bit on that and what your sort of thinking was really in respect to that, because so many of these, and I didn't realize this until I read your chapter, of course, that so many of these words that we receive in terms of soil categorization are rooted in Russian language and are rooted in this, I guess. You could read it through the lens of imperial or colonial kind of categorizations and extractions of soil. Would you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, thank you. So just now I spoke a bit about the larger project that is contains research, but it also contains this being together and practices, and is very much focused on herbal practices or making things, on collecting, on doing things with our hands, to do with like preparing, making medicine from herbs, feeding ourselves with them. And as you said at the beginning, there is only like we there's a very close relationship to that from just one generation in this part of the world. And that has to do with the way socialist context has both foregrounded this type of relation and the type of collectivity that we know was kind of associated with, having cooperative, like working the land in kolkhoz setups. So being in this relationship to soil in a collective way, being in relationship to plants in a collective way, which is something that a lot of so it is the way through which these practices have remained quite present, but also it is a response. Of course, they didn't come with socialism or like with socialist ideas, our state socialist ideas. They were there from before. They have all this history that predates by much this kind of collectivized forms of practicing healing, let's say, or practicing tending to land, and being attentive to, yeah, what's in there, to the soil. But so at the same time, it being a social, a state socialist system, and in as is in the case of the USSR, like having a history of imperial organization of knowledge and an imperial organization of science that can be traced back to connect with colonial European science because of the participation of Russian scientists, for example. There's an anecdote in the text about how a full cubic block of soil has been presented, of this particular type of soil, very that we will talk about, a very a humus-rich soil was presented in the World Exhibition. So there's this participation of pre-USSR imperial Russia to this type of knowledge creation and this type of colonial way of extracting and understanding productivity, which we know is also at the same time that agriculture, like mass agriculture, emerges. And so what happens within state socialist management of the soil becomes a really just a huge operation and very organized. And then, as we know, in late capitalism, it just ends up in a monocultural format. But w how I arrive at these scales or these big frames is through these small pamphlets, like you said. And I am in this library, in this space, and I find, because it's a former school, there's a lot of material there. So the material has all been kept. Since then, since like about 4 years ago, we've kind of gone through materials. People with understanding of the Estonian context have also gone through it, who speak the language. But it wasn't just all in Estonian, it was also in Russian. Because, yeah, this is what, and it's quite telling and interesting how it was used in as educational material for kids, and it was particularly a boarding school. There are these like quite bewildering images that to me read very gay and very queer and very like trans, and like these figures that are just showing how to be in nature. There's guides for everything. There's guides on how to fish, on how to walk, on how to hike, on how to exist. And then there's a lot of this, like, is this very small, but has been central to the collage work that I was doing around this, guides on weightlifting. So you have these figures and this kind of taxonomical breaking down of both human bodies, animal bodies, and like sections of soil, sections of landscape, images of landscape. So all of these just go in the collages, and you can see in the PDF for sure, but maybe like there's like a printed, oh, this is not gonna work. Oh yeah, it works kind of. So they become these ways of processing for me the connections between scales. So human scale, in historical political scales, in the case of USSR, like scales of how much land was being occupied, and one other thing, another material that I found there that is very informative for the work is an atlas, and it's called It's an atlas of the medicinal plants of the USSR. That's what it's called. And with this atlas, it's quite funny because I don't have Russian language. Like, I can't speak any Slavic language. Funnily enough, Romania is this kind of like, also Hungarian is more close to Finnish, actually. But Romania's got this like Latin roots. So, I don't have access to Russian. My parents' generation was the last generation where Russian was taught in schools. And there's a lot of rejection of that because it was like imposed to be taught. So I'm looking through this atlas with like a translator app. So everything is very glitchy and quite confusing, but there are these huge plates. So it's a whole cartographic effort that the USSR has done in mapping on the whole territory of the USSR. So the scale is absolutely unimaginable now, even with other technologies that we have at hand, because the scale is still really huge. So each medicinal plant is mapped onto the whole occupied territory of the USSR, and it's plate by plate by plate. And this was done as a cartographic effort. And it shows very much how this is about plants that occur and you can forage, but it's also about cultivation. So these like central points of like how can you extract from what is there and how could you like maximize the resources. So medicinal plants and are a resource to be extracted as other resources. So that's one big work that I'm still, and this is held in the library at Masia. And then at the same time, there's another piece, which is a cartographic effort that is done in Romania, in the Socialist Republic of Romania in 1960, which is mapping soil on the territory of the Socialist Republic. So this kind of idea of like, okay, we have to show our resources and we have to map them and visibilize them, and we have to it's not just that, it's also an effort to connect to a history of like to connect Romanian science and this effort, this monographic effort, to the Russian imperial science. Not to, it's kind of bypasses the whole, it's like we don't care about USSR right now, but we are interested in the Russian soil science history, so the imperial histories of soil science. And it makes a lot of sense to how Socialist Romania was placing their project. Is very much a Marxist-Leninist project, but it's also an ethno-nationalist project that just jumps into create into the 19th century quite a lot, into this like nation building. So for me, that's also heteropatriarchy, nation building, and like incorporating bodies of humans, of plants, of anything that it can grab. Is kind of at the core of this. And Dokuchaev stands as this like, yeah, image that keeps appearing, because he is, yeah, the person that is cited in the Romanian monograph the most and trying to be aligned with and trying to say, look, we're doing work as good as this.
Okay.
We're like in line with the, yeah,
Yeah.
scientific knowledge.
That's really interesting, I guess, because also the there's parallels there to Finnish independence and a similar mapping. Actually, Tuomo Tampana, who's tuning into this call at this moment in time and is one of the co-founders of Kubu, actually many years ago we did a project together called Pop-Up Landscapes, which was looking at how to, and this was mid-2000s, how to think about creating a kind of an impression of your land in a future, in to like a, as a kind of almost future postcard, And that brought us into looking at how landscape was mapped in different regions. We were working in Finland and Portugal at the time, and a bit in the UK. And so I can feel like a lot of resonance there with those attempts through which soil categorization, which came about at some of that moment of nation building in a way, and how those impressions then of land and viewing the land and humans relation to what the rural landscape was meant to do for one, in a sense, both in terms of hyper extractivism as we were going towards industrialized agriculture from the 50s onwards, but the basis of it was coming at that particular time. But then also these, imagine, well, not just imaginings, but like landscape as a rural landscape in particular, as a place to rest, to recuperate, to enjoy, and what that then meant to cultivate that as well. So there are these kind of like polarities that were at play. You mentioned you so I didn't sort of really think about all of those kind of connects between Finland and the work that you were doing until you said. So I'm sure there's some more there that we can kind of talk about. But I just wanted to go back to that brilliant example that's in the book, which again just really kind of captured the imagination of that massive cube of soil that was exhibited, and just I guess for people to get a time stamp on this, so Dorkachev's book on Chernozem, which is humus, which is the Russian name for this rich black soil. It came out in 1883, is that correct?
Yeah, I am always very I need to check my numbers because I have a quite a I think so, yeah. That is
So just
correct.
to so so again, so I guess he's categorizing soil at that particular point, and then you get the international expos and the kind of like, look at us humans, we can do amazing things. And you get this cube of Russian soil being literally transported and toured around in a sense, which I guess was celebrating, the wealth of the soil, the mass amount of land that, the country has and holds, and these ideas that also are kind of quite dominant in our imaginary of USSR as productive, as farming, as the breadbasket of the world, really, in a sense, which I guess is what was actually being, said to us, really, in a way.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's yeah, that image. So I was trying to find like so it's a huge basically like quite a massive I was looking it up, I think, and it's like a container, half a container kind of type soil of soil. So as a block somehow, I can't imagine. I want to look, this is something that I would love to look more into. I only found one resource talking about this, but yeah, for me, what was very interesting about that is that it's such an evidence to how there's a coeval, like there's a connective temp like in the timelines, in the historical timelines, if we're talking right now about a decolonial project and how are we going to do that from this place of for me it's like okay, how are we doing that from Eastern Europe? How am I doing that from Romania specifically? Then it's to dig deep, sorry for the pun, but like to dig into this kind of into the facts of how do things actually connect? How are these histories of science? And specifically in this case, I'm just looking at this one thread of like soil science. So Romania does this big effort in 1960 to really establish itself as a socialist republic, and a lot of it, as we know, around like socialist. Yeah, productivity in that sense is about okay, what are your resources? And it was grains, and then suddenly with this exercise, it's like, oh, but there's soil. Soil is like a very important one. And there's a claim there in the book that says, well, In Romania, from the Black Sea to the mountains, we have as much soil as the USSR has on like the territory. Now, of course, the USSR highest concentration of the Chernozem is actually in Moldova, which is really close to Romania, which historically is also very a territory that like Romania has occupied and then the USSR occupies. And because it's ceded by Romania to the USSR. And then right now, when you have this surge of ethno-nationalist movements and fascism in the area, in Romania, one of the manifestations of that is let's integrate Moldova. It's like Moldova is like an independent state. Like, what are we even talking about? Where in time are you right now? So I think there's a lot of confusion about these timelines and they are resurfacing all the time as ghosts. So if the project is to understand something about it from now, I for me it's like really fascinating to understand, okay, how was it built? How did we arrive here with these imaginations? Because they do come from somewhere. And so Romania tries to become Socialist Republic of Romania wants to go into the 19th century and be like the Russian imperialist soil science and be not like but be in line, be coeval, be understood as precise, as exact, as worthy somehow. So it's very similar to like a colonial race for resources in the sense of you're not necessarily, in the case of Romania, they're not going elsewhere to grab resources, but they are doing this kind of internal look we are having. And these processes of internal colonization are also part of histories of European, like for example, in Spain. Just I'm going into a different direction, but there are also these histories of internal colonization around agriculture and soil practices specifically. But you also speak about the taxonomical orders, and that's also something that fascinated me that right now that I didn't know because obviously I don't have a trade, like not obviously, I should say this. I don't have a training in as a scientist or as a geologist or a pedologist or so soil scientist. So all of this was like just going deep and like being very interested about things. So what I learned about soil science is that it's not a straightforward way right now in the present. We don't have like one way to categorize soil types. So that's because of this history and because you have the Cold War history and then you had US classification system and you have the Russian soil taxonomy, what it's called, quote unquote, Russian soil taxonomy. And then you have something that's emerging right now in terms of right now, like that's been emerging where it's like, okay, we need a world order of soils, which already is kind of strange to think about as a world order. But so this category of the Chernozem was taught to me in schools, in geography as this is very specific to this area. There's no such thing. It's like unique. We only have this here. And this kind of creation of like uniqueness, but is also part of just ethno-nationalist projects in general, right? Like this land is so special. Of course, it's special because you are like inhabiting and caring for it and all of that, but through science, a kind of, this kind of loop where no, scientifically proven, this land is the best kind of land because it holds this best kind of soil. So something is going on there with that, with the creation of that category of the Chernozem. And it's interesting that if you say this word Chernozem, a lot of people, well, probably people my age or older now, because the information is not shared as much anymore, but who had some experience of like socialist education or very immediate post-socialist education will recognize it, will be like, yeah, that's something I know, but I don't really know much about it. So that was a kind of sense of curiosity. There's like something in my body that like says, yeah, I understand this, but I don't know what it is. So yeah, there's like the drive to look into it.
It's one of the things that I also really enjoyed actually about the sort of the research period for The Garden and the Hedge, which I was sort of sharing with some colleagues last night, that I grew up in a farming area and a farming region, and I guess these kind of questions of the liveliness of soil, the richness of soil, what soil, you know, a kind of a very innate understanding of what soil is doing, and actually and the healing properties of it, because literally it's putting food on your table. So there's a very kind of like direct relation to it. But of course, I haven't been inhabiting that community or space also on a daily level for, you know, m most of my adult life now. And The Garden and the Hedge brought me back into that. And I found my sort of my body responding actually in a different way, even when I was writing a text, which we haven't yet shared, but probably will in the future, that kind of informed the work in a sense. And this sort of liveliness of soil, you know, and these stats now that are kind of come out of, there's like 50,000 species in a gram of soil, you know, which is blowing the minds of people really in a way, because it's part of an effort to support and articulate, I guess, how important soil is and the current, you know, degradation of soil, which is happening at a global level that is so unprecedented, really, in a way that food security now is like, you know, a massive actually issue, and is probably getting these questions of, you know, real, I think, grounding elements that are cut across all cultures, all people. This will affect all of us, in a sense, are being, you know, subsumed, and we are just being distracted by sort of like other propagandas at the moment, because actually to secure that soil requires particular types of collaborative efforts in a sense. So you kind of touch upon some of those things as you close out of the chapter in a way, and you know, I can sort of your collages that you incorporate within the work, which, you know, I read as a sort of a way to help us traverse soil, to think about, to kind of, you know, when I was reading the chapter, and the way that you organize the collages, I felt I was like traveling down to the soil, you know, which is the very feeling I had when I was like, you know, working on The Garden and the Hedge. You know, I'm tra I'm I've been traveling through soil now for like a couple of months. And the other thing that kind of came up with this, which is really interesting to hear you break down some of these further attempts of soil classification that are happening, is that as part of the closing weekend at Khubu, there will be a little ceremony that I will be holding that's called Soil Protocol, because the first soil protocol actually got established, and it uses that terminology, protocol, in the Alpine region in 1993, as a actual condition that those bordering countries, which there's, you know, Switzerland, France, Italy, there's quite a few that, you know, can combine around the Alpine region, would understand that they can't do certain things because they want to protect that soil. Yeah. And even, you know, why isn't there those protocols in other places? You know, that's sort of what it made me sort of think of. So again, you get this very, you know, this place is unique, you know, kind of happening. So I guess I've got a few kind of questions to sort of fold out with. One which goes back to these points around this hyper-categorization of soil that you have referred to in all these attempts. How do you see that in relation to this question of soil degradation and depletion at this moment? So maybe let's take that first, and let's see where it leads.
Yeah, so it's interesting that it was called the breadwinner soil, this type of soil, the black soil, within this context. So because it had such like high productivity of crop rotation. And so it was wheat probably most of the time because you would have bread and like the breadwinner trope as well, like is very much like associated with like that part, like Eastern Europe, Eastern Europe mostly. But then I cite in the text this research that says that basically in Moldova, where there's like a high concentration of black soils or Chernozem, there has been, so 140, I'm just gonna just mention the time frame. So at the 140 years, so this was published in 2019, and 140 year after Dokuchaev comes up with this category and speaks about it and integrates it in this way into some sort of nation building as well, as the breadwinner, and create like there's this soil science effort to create these categories and to formally include this one. The reduction in humus, so like the fertility of the soil decreases by 43.2%. So that, of course, we know is because of our practices. That's because of what soil science of now understands, like you said, the variety within soil and specifically the need not to turn soil, which is one of the biggest reasons why there's degradation in the soil quality, because we have just been turning it and destroying the microorganisms that are so essential to like a healthy soil ecology and to actually having nutrients in what grows from the soil. So like we're only now understanding that, okay, there's a resource and we have abused it, and this whole project has been about the resource. It's not been about, yeah, any kind of it's been a very focused classification and extractive exercise, which for me, as you say, in the effort that is this initial way of putting words down and thinking through the collages, is always coming through the body of like and through lived experience of what does it mean to categorize, to put in boxes, to, for example, around gender and lived gender identity. We all know that this is also a colonial practice, and it's the science of colonialism. With botany, you have that very clearly with Carl Linnaeus, who just decides that there's this like binary understanding of plants. This is the stamen, and this is the pistil, and this is how we've like. And with soil, you have these other types of categorization that, before Dokuchaev, it wasn't even seen as an alive element. So he does have this contribution. It's seen like rock, basically. So he does bring this contribution of aliveness somehow to understanding the soil and understanding biota, like understanding life, basically, that the soil is alive, that there is aliveness in the soil. And so it's just like a very important political project to keep, trans people alive, black people alive, queer people alive, trans women alive, indigenous people alive, soil alive. It's just essentially about that, like keeping ourselves alive to some point, and especially those groups of people that like there's so much grief in the soil as there is in the world. So we see that these exercises to destroy life, these necropolitical exercises, we are living for 2.5 years, witnessing directly a genocide. We're seeing the effects of lack of how the tactic of not feeding a population is a genocidal tactic by Israel right now. And destroying of land and destroying of possibilities of soil. And we see these kind of small acts of resistance coming from Palestinians where they're still literally growing in dust. I don't know, like a tomato plant. So this insistence on aliveness is just a in a sense, not to glorify it and at all because it shouldn't happen, but it's just an essential political act to in the world that we are right now. Yeah.
Thank you. And I think inside of those, narratives that are happening, though, there's always these counter stories in a sense. And I think that's what was sort of being weaved into the chapters sort of as well, is that and while again you close with these points towards sort of grief and loss, I'm actually thinking about going back to that point of sort of socialist herbalism, in a sense, which somehow in its wording creates some sort of sense of hope, I feel, in a way, even though it's referring to particular time frames, land, location, and its lockdown. I guess the word social in its own way sort of thinks through. And where have you seen those sort of stories of hope emerging within this conversation and this sort of uncovering of histories and categorizations of soil and categorizations of plant kind of use, in a sense, thinking about like permacultures or ways that a very entangled and sympathetic relation towards plant and soil has also lived on in these places too, which is evident, like, as we were sharing, when you go through the countries like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, it's forms of subsistence farming very alive in those countries in ways that are not necessarily in some other European countries. So before maybe I invite anyone to drop a question into the chat if they have now, I guess that's where I'd like to kind of go. Where do you see some of the stories of hope, and what's next for you in terms of the many lines of work that this very generative kind of period of investigation at a rural school, which I think is so poetic, given that is also situated in a former school in a rural place. And it just makes me think of what happens then when you inhabit these rural places, when you go and you have time that's completely cut off from many other things. These are maybe the generative spaces through which we can maybe actually start to think of other again. So yeah, stories of hope, where next?
Yeah, thank you. I think somehow it's about when you first started, I was having these images, and one of the images I do put in this chapter is so the Masya is one in the short version. Yes, these places like a place where you can have access to being and hearing your body, hearing things outside of your body. But so one image that I put in the book is next to the building, there was a very, very big linden tree. The linden tree fell in one of the storms. It was very close to the building. It fell the opposite side. It could have easily fallen on the building. So that was a very, in itself, is a story of hope one. Hope one. Hope two is the linden tree fell, but some, and so a lot of its root is exposed, and then a lot of the soil where it's created its home, their home, is still it's very visible to us, so we can just see this little space of a, yeah, like and so we were wondering what will happen. And so, but the linden tree starts making, continues to make flowers after it's been fallen down. And as a collective, we decided that's the greatest thing ever. because you can see it there just lying down, being very tired, just barely making it, but just kind of making some flowers. And there's another, I think there's an apple tree that grows around. And then one of our, whom I thank in the book for this, one of our friends and part of the collective, so they plant at the base of the linden tree where there's this soil that has been exposed. They plant, if you know, the three sisters. So Luti plants the three sisters to connect to their own heritage of like in Me connected to Mexican soils where this practice comes from, to plant together beans, squash or pumpkin, and corn. And that's because they help each other in a way that you don't have to support either of them. So the corn grows tall, the beans use the corn to climb on, so you don't have to create climbing structures for the beans. And then the squash covers the ground, so there's not weeds are not coming from the ground to stress any of them, because squash is like so strong and like goes on the ground, and it's like so like has my friends, so you're not gonna get to them. So yeah, this becomes an image of hope two. I'm making a triptych right now, I guess. And there's a hope three maybe, where a lot of people there are interested in mushrooms, and we had the queer mycology gathering, and our friend Chilla from Hungary, who says has been trained as a mushroom inspector. Because in Hungary, and I think in Finland as well, there are still these services where you can go with the mushrooms you foraged and show them, and they can like really make sure that you have not picked up poisonous ones. As our mushroom inspector tells us that on the bark of the tree grows a mushroom that is called Schizophyllum commune. And this mushroom, one thing about it is it has, so it's basically the epitome of gender fuckery, because it has, so humans have these chromosomes that we know about, and we think that that's connected, or that the story goes is like that gives you your gender. So there's two we are working with. And then the combinations of those tell us, and then of course there's intersex people that we even cannot even comprehend. So think that unfortunately, the thing that like then Schizophyllum commune has over 20,000 of these kind of phenotypes to make gender with. So like the combinations and the possibilities, we cannot even like, and maybe there is somebody who would do like a really cool computational exercise. I would love that. Maybe I'll like ask my students if someone's up for this, to see, you know, how many kinds of gender can Schizophyllum commune make. The second very cool thing about this mushroom is that it glows in the dark when you put UV light on it. So, just like things on your body would glow in the dark when you put UV light on, or our bodily fluids would go in the dark. So, yeah, like the images, some trans and queer bodies are just lying on this tree with this mushroom, with the three sisters, with the little flowers that are still growing in this kind of completely rural and kind of scary place in other ways for these types of bodies. So yeah, maybe that's just in itself, just an image.
No, I think that is a very wonderful image to hold of what you described so beautifully as well, of the tree that fell, the flowers, the mushrooms. I'm hesitant to actually say any more because I think that's a good way to close a conversation with such a description and to hold that perhaps as the direction to leave in. Such a beautiful picture. Thank you, really.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I'm excited to hear if anybody has
Yes, exactly.
questions
And
or thoughts or anything. It doesn't have to be a question.
we had also checked in, Miha, you're happy for people to connect with you on a one-to-one if now is not your time, or you would like to just gestate on things and that you're open to people connecting.
Absolutely.
Do you want me to share your email in the chat? Because then.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be amazing. And also, yeah, just
Doing.
if anybody wants to know more about any of the things, the threads, the places, the materials, please, yeah, do write to me.
And I'm also sharing for those who might have been late into the room that the work that we were speaking about, or that Mia was speaking about, relates to a book that was chap that was published recently in Post-Communist Grounds, which is the link that I shared there again, which you can download for free or order through the Institute of Net Network Institute in Holland. And I'm inviting you all to join us next Friday at the same time, same place. So 12:30 Finnish time or EES time, 11:30 Central European time or 10:30 GMT time, as those seem to be the common times that we're operating across for a conversation with Sarah Roberts, who is a curator and an educator who has specialized in working in heritage sites and in rural context. And that conversation will be very much about what does it mean to work in rural places, build up audience, create context for artists to come. And so Sarah has over 30 years, 40 years in this field. So I think it will be also a really interesting conversation. On that note, I would just like to say massive thanks to Miha for joining us, for everybody who has tuned in, many colleagues and friends here who are also connected to No School in France. So a little shout out to everybody there, and also to Tumo Tampana, who's the co-founder and of Kubu, who at the moment has been flicking in and out, you might have seen, as he is actually currently on a sailing residency with a little bit of a glitchy Wi-Fi. So yeah, I'm going to look forward to seeing some of you face to face in a few moments for lunch. And Miha, I will see you soon at our workplace. So yeah, thank you again, and check out earth.kubu at Finland, and see you all quite soon. Thank you so much, Miha.
Thank you so much, Teresa, and everybody for listening in. And please, yeah, get in touch if you want to know more. I put the website again, so.
Thank you. And I just really would just like to say to the linden tree
Yes.
and to the soil, the really
Yeah.
beautiful, beautiful stuff that's our foundations. I'm just gonna just like give it out to them.
Yeah, for the Thank you so
Right.
much, everyone.
Yeah,
Have
thank
a good
you.
day. Thank you for inviting me.
See you then. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.